the 20th century, resets were characterized by depression in the 1930s and bouts of recession, particularly in the UK, which is where my experience has mainly been throughout my life. But looking at the global economy, we produced a paper in 2017, which was published in the Islamic Economics Journal of King Abdulaziz University, where we've been predicting this financial crash because the problems that arose during the subprime crisis of overdebtedness and the system needing a reset, if anything, they're more acute now. And this economic collapse, I think when the tariffs were first imposed earlier this year, we said this could well be a trigger for economic collapse because clearly it's yet another problem that people have to face. I think it's also worth looking at the actual numbers that are always published, because most governments in the West have been understating unemployment and inflation for a long, long time. They've been overstating growth as a result. But essentially, the economies have been hollowed out. There's been corporate greed, so there is more and more extraction of resources and energy from people in terms of price increases that are never reflected in the inflation statistics. I would argue that the unemployment rate doesn't reflect all the people who have effectively been ignored in all this, people who, for whatever reason, can't work because of the way the economy has changed. I mean, America, which is ostensibly one of the richest countries in the world, has a huge sort of population, homeless population problem, as well as, I can't remember the numbers, but millions on food stamps. So this is not, you know, a recent Trump originated problem. It may well be exacerbated by his recklessness in applying sanctions here, there, and everywhere. Trade wars are never good for anyone. But the wider context is that the economy is in a slow motion train crash, and it's now accelerating. One indicator is the price of gold. And when we first started talking about when economic collapse comes, the gold price will start to rise. It was trading not far above $1,000 an ounce. In the last 5 years, it's doubled and it's around $4,000 an ounce. That's in spite of vast manipulation of the gold market, a huge overhang of paper assets representing gold, but not real gold. In other words, for every ounce of gold that is traded, there is maybe more than 200 ounces actually traded on the back of that 1 ounce. So clearly,
let's put a pause there and let's bring Mr. Patillo back in on the discussion.
Comes, that will be exacerbated.
Sure, that was a very detailed account by Mr. Menzies. Robert Patillo, New Harris Poll. It shows Americans are continuing to feel financial strain and are growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. What level of alarm should this be raising at the Trump White House that actually ran on a promise of affordability?
This would be a five-alarm fire. Remember that this issue is what brought down the Biden presidency. That the fact that he could not get inflation under control, they could not get economic growth under control, and people felt like the economy was sputtering and it would do better under Trump. Ultimately, that's what ended the Biden presidency above all else. There was the distrust of the Biden economic policies that cost Kamala Harris in large part the last election. However, if you look at the U.S. economy right now, there are seven companies passing billions of dollars back and forth that are propping up the market. The AI startups, the NVIDIAs of the world, the Magnificent Seven, these companies are essentially floating the American economy right now. So the stock market and the economic numbers look better than they are because you have these massive investments into AI, massive investments into data centers, this regulatory framework that the Trump administration put in where there essentially is no regulation on these AI companies. And so for regular everyday working people, they're not privy to that part of the economy. They're not privy to the benefits there. And so you have a two-tiered economy. You're seeing a K-shaped economic development where the people at the bottom of the economy are sinking lower, the people at the top of the economy are rising higher. And when you have that level of income inequality and that distribution of wealth in the nation, that always leads to political problems and ultimately revolutions.
Mr. Menzies, economists point to one major culprit behind the rising costs, and that's Trump's aggressive and also increasingly erratic tariff regime. In your opinion, have the tariffs done more harm than good on prices?
Your sound is breaking up, so I didn't get the whole of the question, but you're asking what is the significance of the tariffs in all this. I think undoubtedly they are exacerbating an already fragile situation, but I think it's not accurate to say that Trump's erratic behavior is causing all of these problems. I think it's causing many problems in the world, but I'm not sure it's the root cause of the economic situation, which is deep-rooted in the structure and has been for decades, if not centuries, that our debt-based money system is coming to the end of its useful purpose. I think it's also worth, your other guest made the comment about NVIDIA and AI companies attracting millions or trillions of investment. There are effectively two economies, and what became clear in the subprime crisis of 2008, that all of the money that was being created and sucked in the TARP relief and the bank bailouts actually went into asset prices. So this has been a process that has been ongoing. If you track the S&P 500 against central bank intervention, every time there was weakness in the market, the central bank would intervene, and that would end up in asset prices. So you cited earlier the real problems faced by people with the rise of the cost of their weekly shopping or monthly shopping basket. That is almost divorced from the whole financial system in terms of the speculation and the asset bubbles that form. And people are calling the current AI investment boom a bubble and calling the top. But I think in the same way that the subprime crisis was an inevitable requirement to try and rebalance this crazy system that we have of debt-based money. And so I think that, you know, whilst the tariffs may, when we look back, have been the trigger, I think the inevitability of this collapse is not caused by some political action or other. It's caused by the structural nature of the problem we face, and the bank bailouts and everything that followed, where effectively the criminals are still in charge of the casino that they were in charge of in 2008, and arguably the problems today are much worse than they were back then.
Mr. Petillo, staying with the issue of tariffs, instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have actually pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Unpack for us what the end game is with regards to the tariffs.
The tariffs are more of a power move than an economic move. President Trump is using them as a weapon of diplomacy and a weapon of war against other nations. It's not about whether or not they actually have any economic output. It's about forcing other nations to the negotiating table and then bringing in these trade deals that he signs every few months in exchange for tariff relief. It's very much almost a mobster mentality when it comes to how they're using the tariffs. There's no economic model that tells you that you put 145% tariff on one of your largest trading partners and things get better. That doesn't make sense. But if you can use that 145% tariff against China to bring them to the table to sign a new deal to provide rare earth minerals that can then be put into microchip manufacturing for, again, those big seven companies that are investing in these areas, well, then now you start seeing what this is more so about. It has nothing to do with the majority of American people. It's about the Trump administration being sure that they are using every tool possible to prop up the millionaires and billionaires who supported his candidacy and who made sure he got back into office. So the tariff policies are less about the rest of America and more about those top seven companies and those people who have invested in President Trump.
Hi, Menzies. Trump promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. And now we know annual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming the prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. So the question is, what happens if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies?
Well, clearly it's not going to improve things if nothing changes. I think it's also worth, one of the things that we haven't touched on is the sort of political dimension of all of this in terms of what the relative power, economic power of BRICS and the relative importance of BRICS, because one of the things that Trump's move, aggressive moves against China and other countries, is to actually get the BRICS to actually accelerate or expand their activities between them. So to some extent, in global terms, the America or the Trump administration has shot itself in the foot, because in promoting this trade war, I suspect that they will suffer more because of their isolation from BRICS than, you know, given the parlous state of the UK and Western Europe at the moment. I mean, Germany is struggling. So, you know, Trump may want to favor his friends, but he seems to have issued tariffs against almost everyone, friend and foe alike. So I think the only one thing that one can predict with Trump is that he is unpredictable, and who knows where they go from here. If they do double down, then it's clearly not going to help. But I suspect that other factors that I've alluded to earlier in terms of the structural nature of the problem will make what they do largely irrelevant anyway.
Robert Petillo, the typical American household now spends $208 more every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier. And according to some numbers, around $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the country was emerging from the pandemic. With these numbers at hand, are Americans buying into Trump's affordability push?
No, a recent poll just out this week showed that President Trump's approval rating on the economy, I think, is negative by almost 70 points. I mean, the American people see what's going on, and they understand you can't just talk your way out of these economic numbers. And also, should we mention that at the same time that we're seeing these rises in prices, the federal minimum wage in America remains $7.25 an hour. It has been so for nearly 20 years. And there are certain states in the country where the state-level minimum wage is actually $5.25 an hour. So there are places where you can work at a grocery store for $7.25 an hour, and after an hour not be able to buy anything in the grocery store that you work at. And this is unsustainable. This is not something that can survive for the average American person. And right now, with these mass deportations taking place, their goal, I believe, is to push many people who are currently in the middle class down into those lower class positions, so that you're going to be replacing immigrant labor with people who are currently middle class, because those are going to be the only jobs available. And that creates an even larger gap in our economic system between the poor and the rich. And it also benefits the people at the top of the economy. I think people did, for some reason, there's a large number of Americans that thought that when you elected a billionaire, somehow he was going to make everybody a billionaire. No, you elected a billionaire to make the billionaires trillionaires.
Robert Petillo, I want to stay with you for the next question. Just on the issue of discontent with the administration, lower-income families are looking at Donald Trump, who's more concerned about the new White House ballroom. And another issue I want to squeeze in here is the level of awareness that Americans have now on how Donald Trump has been putting Israel first, not America first. Something that has even divided the MAGA camp in America.
Yeah, there's actually a what they call the MEGA camp, which is the Make Israel Great Again portion of the Republican Party. And when you ran on a platform of America First, you ran on a platform of non-intervention around the world, no foreign wars, concentrating on American issues, and then everything that you've done has either been to the benefit of the Israeli government, meeting with the Saudis, making deals with Qataris, threatening to invade Venezuela. The people are not seeing this thing as America First agenda, and the folks who elected Donald Trump are struggling even more than ever, and they don't see the same attention being put towards domestic issues. Now, on the end of this year, in about 6 weeks, the Obamacare subsidies are going to be ending. Meaning, as many as 7.2 million Americans will lose access to affordable health care come January 1st. There's absolutely no plan among President Trump or Congressional Republicans to do anything about that. We just saw 42 million Americans have their food assistance payments be delayed. And if it wasn't for the Democrats ending the government shutdown, we would be seeing people starving for the holiday season. So there are real issues in America. And then when you see the president, prostrating himself in front of the dictator of Saudi Arabia, dancing around with the funders of Hamas from Qatar, putting every part of American foreign policy in the hands of Israel, people rightfully are saying the concentration is not on the kitchen table issues of average Americans.
Sure. Clive Manzi's the job report itself, it was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption that was triggered by political brinksmanship in Washington. What are the macroeconomics, or the macroeconomic costs, rather, of a U.S. government shutdown? Because they always cost the economy billions of dollars. So why does Congress still do this?
Well, I think it's indicative of a system that is clearly not fit for purpose, but this has become almost an annual ritual of this brinksmanship. And somehow it seems to get resolved. But I think it's indicative of a much wider issue. When you talk about, people having to spend more to put things in their shopping basket, I think, I have no direct experience of what's happening in the States, but certainly in the UK, what seems to be happening is that there's a sort of a leapfrogging effect as, business costs go up, so they put up their prices, and it's almost like one's in a situation where they're trying to get the prices, they're seeing what they can get away with rather than maintaining any sort of semblance of trying to make life easier for customers. So in terms of the government shutdown, what that will do is obviously it will lead to costs, but you think about your last guest talked about Israel and make Israel great again. I mean, the amounts of money that have been spent by Western governments on Ukraine, on Israel, on the COVID PSYOP, on the green agenda, all of these things have been sucking resources out of the ordinary people's pockets and their energy. And so, the government shutdown is more political theater that merely sucks out the resources as it goes along. And people are increasingly turning away from government and looking for other ways of sustaining themselves. And that is in line with the way the structure is changing, which we've discussed on other programs. So although in financial terms, things look very dire and it's very difficult, as people become more adept at avoiding government structures and finding other ways of satisfying their needs on a more collaborative basis, then this will begin to weaken the power of the economy. And as the alternatives become more attractive, more and more people will be involved. And sooner or later, politics becomes irrelevant. But that's a very big conversation, which is quite difficult to encapsulate within a few minutes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to political activist and attorney Robert Petillo joining us from Washington, D.C. Also, thanks to researcher and commentator Clive Menzies joining us from the British capital, London. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
by the stars and how they are fixed. Unlike the tears we cry, we'll continue to lament him long after we all die. Long after we all die, devoid of all our worries, the ashes of our bodies shall all recite the melodies of Hosea's tragedies. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein. Hussein's day is not a day. His day makes the year sway. And if love can take away breath, his love takes souls away. His love takes souls away. The whole world we can forget, yet our eyes shall remain wet. The whole world can end, and yet his sun shall never set. We will never forget Hussein. Drowning, we were saved by him, our rock of salvation. God placed tears of Hussein within our creation, within our creation. And so towards him we're drawn, his own. So that for him we mourn. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein. We won't forget Hussein's wounds, the 1700, nor shall his 72 be lost for a second, be lost for a second. And the 6-month-old infant, and the scorched and the burning tent, against the face of tyrants, for them all we lament. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein. If our legs were taken away, to your grave we would crawl. Your grave became a Kaaba, that even the stars circle. That even the stars circle. The wounds from which you would ache, a house of God they would make, for God's pleasure and your sake, we'd come crying to your mother, and to her rib broken, we'll remember till the earth by this love is shaken. this love is shaken. One day beside her lost son, Mehdi the awaited one. We shall mourn her martyr son, that from our skies is gone.
Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein.
Welcome to Iran Radio, dear listeners. I'm speaking to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. In total, 25 prophets are mentioned in the Holy Quran in different chapters. Prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times in the Holy Quran, making him the most mentioned prophet of all in the Holy Book of Allah. The literal meaning of the word Quran is the which is being read. The word Quran is repeated 70 times in the Book of Allah itself. The month of Ramadan is the only month of the year mentioned in Quran in verse 185 of chapter Al-Baqarah, or second chapter. Our next program is For a Better Life, a practical ethics program focused on Islamic values in everyday situations. From relationships to discussion making, we break down moral guidance into steps you can actually apply. Following that, it's time for one more segment of our radio productions. And then we return to the majestic words of Quran with Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, For a Better Life. Stay close.
This is For a Better Life. For a Better Life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. When the heart breaks, the light enters. When the soul weeps, it begins to see. Every wound is a door to wisdom. Peace and blessings, dear listeners. Welcome to For a Better Life on IRIB English Radio, where we explore the wisdom of life through the lens of faith, poetry, and truth. This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you on this episode. Today, we speak of something that touches every heart. Pain. The pain of loss, failure, heartbreak, or disappointment. No one escapes it, but few understand it. For those who believe pain is not the end, it is the beginning. Every hardship, when faced with faith, becomes a teacher. And as Sa'di said, the thorns of sorrow bloom into roses of insight. Sa'di's world was not free from pain. He traveled through wars, poverty, and exile. Yet he wrote, "The diamond is born under pressure. The rose grows from the thorn. The soul matures in hardship." He saw pain not as a punishment, but as purification, a sacred fire that burns away illusion and leaves behind clarity. The Holy Book of Quran says, "And we will surely test you with something of fear, hunger, loss of wealth, and lives and fruits. But give glad tidings to the patient." And in another verse we hear, "Perhaps you dislike a thing which is good for you, and love a thing which is bad for you. Allah knows, and you do not." These verses teach us, hardship is not rejection, it is refinement. What feels like loss may be the very soil of growth. Imam Ali alayhi salam had said, "Don't hate what befalls you, for every drop of pain carries wisdom unseen." Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also mentions, "When Allah loves a servant, he tests him, for through pain the soul becomes clean." And Imam Hussein alayhi salam at the battlefield of Karbala transformed the ultimate suffering into the eternal strength. He didn't curse the pain, he embraced it as the path to truth. In their example, we see faith does not remove pain. It transforms it. Now, pain awakens the sleeping heart. When life is easy, we forget to reflect. Hardship makes us humble. Pain teaches empathy. The one who has suffered can truly comfort others. Pain purifies intention. In suffering, we see what really matters. Pain strengthens resilience. As Sadi says, the wind tests the tree, and the storm reveals its roots. Now, let's hear a story of Sadi Shirazi after a very short break.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back to For a Better Life on the episode of Pain. Understanding it, finding it a door to improvement, and knowing the way our faith can transform it. A man once asked Sadib, "Why does God the Merciful allow pain?" Sadi replied, "Because mercy without wisdom would spoil us. He gives bitterness to awaken the taste for sweetness." In Islamic thought, pain is not cruelty, it's a medicine, often bitter, but healing. Imam Ali alayhi salam had said, "When Allah wants to elevate a servant, he cuts from him the ropes of comfort." And Sadi tells of a potter who made a perfect vessel, but it cracked in the kiln. He wept for his loss, then he looked inside and saw the light shining through the crack. Had it not broken, Sadi wrote, the light could not have entered. In the same way, when life breaks us, something divine enters. A deeper patience, a clearer insight, or a quieter heart. Now, how to transform our pain into wisdom, or what can we know about this transformation? Well, the first thing can be acceptance. Accept, don't resist. Dear listeners, denial deepens the pain. Acceptance begins healing. The next step might be seeking meaning, not blame. Asking, what is this teaching me instead of why me? Turning to Allah in dua. Every heartbreak is an invitation to a deeper prayer. Helping others through our pain. Healing grows faster when shared. And remembering Allah. As Sadi said, the night will not last. Dawn is faithful to return. Now, in today's world, we are taught to escape pain with distractions, entertainment, or even denial. But true healing begins when we face it. Sadi's wisdom and the Quran's light invite us to feel the pain fully, but not to live in it.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Pain becomes poisonous when it's ignored. It becomes wisdom when it is embraced. Now, let's ask these questions from ourselves. Take a moment of thinking about them, and then decide on the changes on our way. Do I see my pain as a curse or a lesson? Have I let my suffering make me bitter or better? What strength or insight did the hardship give me that ease could not? Can I help someone else through the wisdom of what I've endured? So, dear listeners, the garden doesn't bloom without the rain. The rose does not open without a struggle. And the believer doesn't grow without trials. Pain, when held with faith, becomes the soil of wisdom. Every tear waters a seed of light. Sadi whispers to us across centuries. The wound of the heart is where love enters. The burn of sorrow is where light begins. And in the Holy Book of Quran, we are assured, indeed, with hardship comes ease. So if you are in pain right now, remember, know, and repeat this. Allah is near, the night will end, the wound will teach, and one day you will thank Him for what once broke you. And as we close today's reflection, I say to you with warmth and pray, may your heart find light in its cracks, the same way as Sa'di described in his poem. May your pain become your wisdom, as we are supposed to act upon in this way, as our imams have mentioned. And may your soul bloom like the rose that grows from the thorn. Until our next episode, I wish you wisdom. I wish you good moments while you're struggling with any challenges that might be on our way. We all know that our lives are busy, hectic, and sometimes mind-blowing, but still, we can stay strong and we can believe in the rose that will grow after this heavy rain. Until the next time on For a Better Life, I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
With the fall of Bashar al-Assad, a fleeting wave of hope swept across Syria. For a brief moment, many believed a better future was within reach. But those dreams quickly dissolved. The new dawn proved a mirage. Instead of renewal, Syria plunged deeper into crisis. I'm Ali Reza Akhtiarzadeh, and this is In a Nutshell. Power fractured, Israel seized the moment. Exploiting the chaos, it launched hundreds of strikes across Syrian territory and quietly expanded its footprints in the south. In the 2 days following Assad's overthrow, Israel carried out more than 500 airstrikes, targeting both military and civilian infrastructure. Since then, it has been occupying swaths of Quneitra and Dar'a under the banner of preventing extremist threats. Since Assad's fall, Israel's military presence has evolved from opportunistic incursions into a strategic project, one aimed at reshaping southern Syria to fit its security and economic map. From Quneitra to Jabal al-Sheikh, also known as Mount Hermon, Israeli forces have entrenched themselves along key highlands, water basins, and energy corridors. The new balance of power in the Levant increasingly revolves around two words, water and gas. Jabal al-Sheikh, the highest peak in the region, stands as the crown jewel of this expansion. At 2,814 meters, it offers an unrivaled surveillance hub, giving Israel a panoramic view from Damascus to the Mediterranean and deep into Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. To the southwest, Israeli forces have fortified Quneitra, extending their reach to within 20 kilometers of central Damascus. New positions in Rahla, opposite Lebanon's Baqa Valley, now oversee three key routes linking Damascus to Beirut and Baalbek, effectively giving Israel a hand on Syria's western gateways. In Soweida province, Israeli influence is spreading under the guise of supporting the Druze. Following the July 2024 formation of the so-called National Guard, a 3,000-strong Druze force reportedly funded by Israel, Tel Aviv's reach deepened. Netanyahu's public pledges to protect the Druze community signaled more than goodwill. They marked the birth of a semi-autonomous security zone loosely tied to Damascus. Beneath the rhetoric of security, however, lies a contest for control over energy routes and water reserves, the true currency of power in today's Levant. The revival of the long-stalled Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline has only sharpened these rivalries. Once blocked by Assad to protect Russian interests, the project roared back into life after its fall. In December 2024, Turkey's energy minister announced its potential restart once Syria stabilizes. For Israel, that's a red flag. A functioning Qatar-Turkey-Europe pipeline would undercut Israel's own East-Med pipeline ambitions, a direct challenge to its vision of becoming Europe's next gas supplier. Analysts at the Begin Sadat Center warn that this gas race pits two visions against each other. Ankara's dream of an Islamic energy corridor versus Tel Aviv's push for a Mediterranean one. Both see Syria as the crucial crossroads. But Israel's ambitions go beyond gas. Control of water, the lifeblood of the region, has become another front. Through its hold over the Yarmouk River basin and the Al-Wehda Dam on the Syrian-Jordanian border, Israel now wields a strategic lever over both Syria and Jordan. The Golan Basin alone provides nearly a third of Israel's agricultural water needs, and every step deeper into southern Syria secures that lifeline. From Jabal al-Sheikh to Dar'a, Israel's control of springs, rivers, and dams, including Banyas, Raqqat, and Al-Manitra, has turned southern Syria into a meticulously managed zone of influence. In this reshaped landscape, fertile lands once tilled by Syrian farmers are being eyed for Israeli agricultural expansion, their crops destined for regional markets. These same corridors, rich in water and soil, double as potential land routes for future pipelines stretching from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean or Turkey. The fall of Assad was supposed to bring about a bright season for Syria. Instead, it opened a new chapter of domination, one where Syria, fragmented and exhausted, has become a playground for power politics and expansionist ambitions. Israel's quiet conquest of the south is not just about borders, it's about resources, leverage, and rewriting the strategic map of the Levant.
Suffering within, this is the love has dyed me in blood. Not I'm wise, neither mad. Your love caused me overjoy, took my heart and made fond of it. Desire to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain. Now and then, like the winds I blow. Now and then, like the roads I go. Now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm Yunus, mystic of sorrow, suffering wounds from top to toe, in the hands of beloved.
my bride in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك. ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program.
Thank
it's a pleasure to be
us.
With you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then, we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran. And at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned.
إن هذا القرآن الذي جلت
فيه. Well, dear audience, in the first part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, we'll continue our discussion on the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. In our previous episodes, we were talking about the impressive the sounds of the letters of the Noble Quran and how they can be effective. Brother Muhammad, let's continue.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah uses the best words in the best places to convey the meanings and the messages of the Quran. It's impossible to replace one word with another word in the Quran. Allah has chosen the best words. And like we said, just the sound of the words and the letters, they can signify the meanings of the verses. One example is in verse 13 of Surah At-Tur.
يَوْمَ يُدَعُونَ إِلَى نَارِ جَهَنَّمَ دَعَى.
What does this mean? It means the day that they are driven toward hell with severity and harshness. We have two ayns with tashdeed and one noon with tashdeed. Ayn with tashdeed is very rare in the Quran, to have the ayn with tashdeed and the effect that it has. Ayn has this, it has this strong characteristic due to the jahr that it has, and also it's a حروف الحلق, it's pronounced deep in the throat.
Yeah, by jah we mean it's voiced.
It's voiced, yeah. So whenever you say, it's a relatively strong letter. If we ignore the tawassut, actually it's not a khawa, it's a tawassut. It's a letter of tawassut, which means it's in between a weak fricative and a strong plosive. Yeah. So, يَوْمَ يُدَعُونَ إِلَى نَارِ جَهَنَّمَ دَعَى. We could picture how they are being forced. They're being pushed and driven and dragged toward hell by just the عين. The two عينs which have تشديد. And you know, because pronouncing these عينs is a little difficult. We could feel the dragging. We could, you know, we can picture that someone is being dragged and pushed toward hell.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. Dear audience, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Dear audience, in the second segment of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, we all are going to listen to the recitation of verses 11 to 17 of Suratul Insan, recited by Sheikh Ra'fat Hussain. Let's enjoy it. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And what you just listened to was recitation of verses 11 to 17 of Suratul Insan, recited by Sheikh Rafat Hussain. Now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What's interesting about Suratul Insan, which is actually revealed in the honor of the five infallibles, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon his progeny, Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and Lady Fatima Zahra. because, you know, they were the ones who made a vow to Allah that they would fast a few days. And in those days, for three nights, the first night, a poor and needy person came. The second night, an orphan came. And the third night, a captive came. And in all three nights, they gave away their iftar, their breakfast.
Completely.
Completely, yes. And these verses were revealed in their honor. And it's interesting that at the end of every single verse in this surah, we have Aliful Mad, which is actually Waqful Ibdal.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one verse where there's no tanween of fatha, and that is verse 15, which is Qawarir. If you connect this word to the next verse, there would be no tanween. Qawarira, qawarira. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if you stop, you have to pronounce it with aliful mad. And the reason that this word is pronounced with aliful mad is so that the rhyme is the same as the other verses. Mm-hmm. This is why Allah has said that we have to pronounce qawarira whenever we stop at this word. And there were many good rules of tajweed in these verses that were recited. Fawqahumullah. The qaf has tafkhim at the highest level. Sharra. The ra again has tafkhim.
How it should be pronounced, brother?
Qa, with the mouth opens vertically.
Uh-huh.
With the mouth opening vertically while pronouncing the qaf.
And the back of tongue, the root of the tongue is raised.
Yeah. Sharra, the ra has tashdeed and fatha has to be pronounced with tafkhim,
mm-hmm,
and without takrir. If you say sharra dhalika,
yeah, the trilling sound should not be heard.
Trilling sound. And walaqahum nadratan. Nadratan. Just look how Shaykh Ra'fat Hussain pronounces the lads in these verses. He pronounces all of them correctly. Nallaratan. We have to have the stretching of the lad where the side of the tongue touches the molar teeth and wisdom teeth of that side of the tongue, the same, mm-hmm, adjacent molar teeth and wisdom teeth. And we have the stretching of istitala where it starts from the back of the tongue to the tip,
to the tip of the tongue.
And he also pronounced the lads correctly in verses 15 and 16. We have two fiddah. He didn't say fiddah.
Yeah, it is not a plosive.
Yeah, it's not a plosive. He said fiddatin. Okay?
Yes.
وَيُطَافُ عَلَيْهِمْ بِآنِيَةٍ مِّن فِضَّةٍ وَأَكْوَابٍ كَانَتْ قَوَارِيرَ مِّن فِضَّةٍ قَدَّرُهَا تَقْدِيرًا. So again, he very well pronounced the lads without shatta. We have few reciters who actually observe this rule.
And can pronounce lad correctly.
Yeah, lad. Especially whenever a lot is mushaddad and sakin, mm-hmm, it's more difficult to observe this rule. And it's a lot more obvious. This characteristic, istitala, is a lot more obvious whenever it has a tashdeed or sukun. And lot is considered a letter of rakhawa due to the timing that it has. It's a weak fricative because the time that you spend pronouncing the lad is just as much as you would pronounce a letter of rakhawa, such
like
as seen and sheen. Mm-hmm. Ash-shams, wal-luha, wal-luha, ash-shams. See, it's the timing
is the same.
Of course, he should not pronounce lad like law. If you say wal-luha, that's, mm-hmm, incorrect. Wal-luha.
And I think here in these verses we have a lot of rules of Nun Sakina.
Exactly, because of the tanweens. We have so many tanweens and Nun Sakina.
Just talk about one of them.
For example, Nadratan wa Surura, we have Idgham. Jannatan, mm-hmm,